You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
I think it's a very powerful message that this democratic club of the most developed countries in the world does not accept today the Russia of Vladimir Putin.
The G7 wingding is dominated by the Ukraine crisis. Our guests Jeffrey Kaufman and Oscar Guardiola Rivera will join me to discuss that, the D-Day diplomatic dance, and more of the day's top stories. In the second half of the show, the author and journalist Justin Marozzi will tell me about his new book, Baghdad, City of Peace, City of Blood.
Of course Iraqis feel Iraqi, but there isn't that very strong glue gluing them together. Maliki, the current prime minister, is doing what many leaders in the past have done, which is just exploit these divisions. I mean, he's got death squads targeting Sunnis. Swathes of Western Iraq are in al-Qaeda's hands again. The country is in complete turmoil.
Plus, we'll round up the day's news from Colombia and end the show with a review of new books from Paris. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, coming up on Monocle 24 right now. Ahead of all that, however, Jonathan Wheatley has the news headlines.
Russian President Vladimir Putin, uninvited to a G7 summit over Russia's role in Ukraine, parried the snub today with a terse message of bon appétit for world leaders who lunched without him. G7 nations cancelled previous plans to hold the summit in Sochi in a protest against Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimea region in March. Leaders of the United States, Britain, France, Germany, Canada, Italy and Japan held their summit just now without Putin in Brussels. The European Council President Herman Van Rompuy said the summit discussed the world economy.
The G7 is meeting at a time when the global economy has strengthened. The global economic outlook is positive, although with weaknesses in some emerging economies. The fragmentation of the financial markets and the shortage of credits are another concern for growth and jobs. And we are taking decisive measures to address this concern.
Well, journalist Benedict Pavillot says Mr. Putin has suggested that while in France tomorrow to mark the 70th anniversary of the D-Day landings, he could still meet Ukraine's newly elected president, Petro Poroshenko.
There will be other guests, and I'm not going to avoid any of them. I will talk with all of them. So it prompts speculation that indeed President Hollande is going to try to get the first meeting between President Putin and Mr. Poroshenko.
Other news now, and Syrian rebels living in Idlib province in northwest Syria said on Thursday that the re-election of President Bashar al-Assad for another seven-year term was nothing more than a fraud. Assad won 88.7% of the vote in the presidential election. In the Canadian Maritimes, the search continues for 24-year-old Justin Bock, wanted over the killing of three police officers. They were shot dead after responding to reports of an armed man dressed in a camouflage outfit in the city of Moncton in New Brunswick. Two other officers were injured. Damien Terreau is from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
We are still actively looking for the shooter. He is believed to still be in the Pinehurst subdivision area of Moncton. We are urging the people who live in that area to stay inside and lock their doors.
Libya's Coast Guard has picked up over 100 immigrants in its waters to the west of Tripoli on Thursday, Libyan Coast Guard officials said. The 114 men, mostly from Senegal, were detained as they were trying to cross to Europe in a small boat. Here, the British Prime Minister David Cameron's Conservatives are poised to win a vote for a parliamentary seat on Thursday, despite being beaten into third place by an insurgent Eurosceptic party in last month's European elections. Cameron and his party are likely to seize on the victory in Newark in Nottinghamshire as proof that the outcome of the European elections was a one-off protest that will not be replicated at the general election to be held in May next year. And finally, a Florida judge accused of punching an assistant public defender after telling him to stop pissing him off is stepping down temporarily for anger management counselling. Brevard County Judge John Murphy had challenged lawyer Andrew Weinstock to join him outside the courtroom to settle a dispute over the scheduling of a trial date. And that story ends this bulletin of Monocle 24 News.
Music. Thank you, Jonathan. They really should change the slogan on Florida license plates to the "and finally state." You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Oplondo, du Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House. The time here in London is just about to go 18.06, which will be 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, I have broadcaster and Monocle 24 regular Jeffrey Kaufman and Latin American expert and author Oscar Guardiola Rivera, also no stranger to this studio. We'll start with the G7 meeting today in Brussels, from which Russia has been pointedly excluded. This is the first summit of the former G8 since Russia was expelled after helping itself to Crimea earlier this year. The G7 has issued Russia a wigging for its continuing violation of Ukrainian sovereignty, and Vladimir Putin's mini-me, Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev, has responded by accusing the West of cynicism without limit. So there. Jeffrey...
Did you write this? I just want to know. Did you? The mini-me, is that your line?
I did.
That is just so disrespectful.
It is, and I apologize to... Actually, no, I don't. You know, he is, really, Dmitry Medvedev. I mean, it's a living, I guess.
But what, writing this?
Well, this is a living, but also being...
It is well written. I just want to congratulate you.
Well, thank you. But also being, you know, Vladimir Putin's sort of weird little sock puppet. I suppose it pays the bills.
Are you going to apologize to Mini-Me?
He actually may have more of a case. I fear we are deviating from the point. Jeffrey, I'll start with you.
Start again.
Yeah, it can't be a surprise to Moscow that they have not been invited to come and sit down with the cool kids. Can we assume that Vladimir Putin rather banked on a certain amount of ostracism in return for getting Crimea and considered that a fair swap?
Let me answer it another way. Putin may not be invited to the big kids' table, but he's got many of the big kids dining with him. You know, he's having dinner tonight with François Hollande of France. He's having meetings with Britain's Cameron and Germany's Merkel. I mean, apart from Obama, whom he has said he would be happy to meet, you know, those are all the big players, let's face it. You know, he's kind of not at the table, but he is there. I mean, Russia, it's too big to freeze out forever. You know, they had to scold Russia somehow. They're not going to invade and send in NATO troops to bring back Crimea. But, you know, it's a token gesture. But, you know, I think you can understand why the G8, G7 kicked him out. He'll be back. You know, was it a calculated move? I think so, but it seems like he's toned down his rhetoric. It seems like he's not sure he wants many more bankrupt provinces of Ukraine to worry about.
There's a couple of important points there, which is that, as Jeffrey says, Oscar, Russia will be invited back one day because it's Russia. They can't freeze it out forever. And also, nobody in the G7 thinks that Ukraine is getting Crimea back. That's gone, surely, and everybody realizes that. So is this all just theatrics at this point? While everybody tries to figure out how long Russia needs to stay in the doghouse before we move on?
It is theatrics on at least two accounts, as we just heard. In fact, Putin is meeting everyone, if not together, one by one. But on the other hand, what we need to hear the G7 telling us about would be, let's say, you know, the economic crisis, the ECB slashing interest rates to negative, the ongoing negotiations between the EU and the US on a trade agreement that nobody has heard of anywhere in Europe, which may be one of the reasons behind people not voting in European elections or voting for some really unsavory characters. So, yes, this is circus in the worst possible manner.
Well, I'm not sure that I, 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 I take a different view. I think that they had to, the Western leaders had to call Putin. And I think that, yes, Crimea is lost, but I think that Putin has realized that if he goes any further, he's pushing, you know, that he may push too far. And you know, there are historical reasons. Crimea was, after all, part of Russia until Khrushchev gave it away in the 50s. That doesn't mean that taking it the way he did can be sanctioned. But you know, I think the rhetoric does have some legitimacy in this context. And let's face it, we would be sitting here denouncing the Western leaders as wimps if they didn't say something or make some gesture.
A gesture is all it is, though, and you raise an interesting point.
But leadership is sometimes about gestures. You know, I mean, let's face it, leadership requires sometimes that you say things. And draw attention. The problem, as we have talked about many times around this table, is just what exactly would you do if you wanted to stop Putin?
But the problem is that the European public are seeing through the smoke. That's the problem. I mean, leadership works in that way, and of course it is a smoke and mirrors as well, but if it works, this charade is not working. Of course, you're absolutely right in saying that Russia needs to be told that, you know, this is unacceptable. And it is unacceptable by any means. And yet, the fact that there is no clarity, that there is no... Perhaps it would be better to come clean and say, look, yes, by the way, Russians and Ukrainians did sacrifice as many people in the Second World War as everybody else did. So this is not an anti-European Russian plot. And let's bring the whole thing back together again.
Jeffrey, you raised what I think is an interesting point there.
Oh, thank God.
which is the question of, is Russia at this point, is there a respect in which Russia and the G7 are now actually on the same side in trying to scale things down in Ukraine? Because Russia has pushed its luck, but Russia... It wants a certain... You can see that Moscow wants a certain lack of balance in Kiev. That kind of works for them. But they don't want a civil war in a country 15 times the size of Bosnia on their doorstep.
You know, there are conflicting signals on that. You know, and I think Putin is you know, you use dismissive terms, but I think that Putin is just simply lying about the Russian role in eastern Ukraine, saying that there are no Russian forces, no Russian troops, no Russian agents. I mean, it's just simply not true.
I don't think anyone believes that.
No, yeah, nobody believes that. And you know, today I'm reading that Ukrainian border guards, fearing for their life, abandoned the borders, and now Russian trucks, Russian troops, Russian guns are pouring over the border. So is it scaling back? You know, the rhetoric from Moscow maybe, but it seems like the actual, on the ground, the militancy is not. It's worrisome. You know, I think it has the ability to simmer along like some of these other regional Russian wars we've had over the last 10, 15 years.
It also has the ability, as these things often do, to quite quickly escalate beyond the point at which anybody can control it.
I think for Putin, the bigger issues, frankly, the damage it's done to the Russian economy, the drain of capital, the lack of confidence in the Russian economy, which, after all, apart from oil, is pretty much non-existent. And I think his bigger issue is he's got to stop the hemorrhaging, because for all the rhetoric, he doesn't control the world's economic markets.
Well, we'll expand on this idea a little bit by looking forward to the diplomatic shuffling, which is going to take place during the ceremonies commemorating the 70th anniversary of D-Day tomorrow. Putin hasn't been in Brussels, obviously. His name wasn't on the guest list, so not an awful lot of point. But he will be at Normandy, as, of course, will President Barack Obama, among many other Western leaders, and somewhat intriguingly, President-elect Petro Poroshenko of Ukraine. Oscar, should Putin and Poroshenko get together, how to be a fly on the wall, it would be a journalistic privilege beyond measure, but how is that conversation likely to go, do we think?
Well, I don't know if you heard this morning, the Ukrainian ambassador to the United Kingdom pretty much calling the Russians evil and saying that the Russians were ready to wage war on NATO and the West. I mean, with that kind of heightened language, that conversation would go nowhere. Having said that, Putin has made it clear that he would be ready to sit down play the role of mediator. Of course, he cannot be the only mediator. That would make no sense. But what is absolutely clear to all parties involved is that those negotiations need to take place. So we need the West, the West and Putin to twist the Ukrainians' arm to sit down and try and manage this before it gets out of control. And it's already getting out of control. This is a virtual state of civil war in many of the parts of eastern Ukraine.
We talk about symbolic rhetoric from leaders. I mean, you know, it would be a public relations coup for Putin to actually have that meeting, in the sense that it would say, look, you see, I'm talking, I'm recognizing, we're moving forward, we're looking to the future. Does that mean he'll do it? Let's talk to that little fly on the wall.
We were talking about gestures and signal sending, transparent though it may be, in leadership. There's no law that suggests that the president of Russia has to be invited to D-Day commemorations. Would it not have sent more of a signal if they'd said, look, this, seeing as how this was an operation to reverse the seizure of sovereign territory by an expansionist power, would it not have served to isolate Putin more if they just said, you can't come?
I think that's unthinkable. I mean, Russia's sacrifice during the Second World War, it was staggering. And I think to politicize that, I just don't think anybody would go there.
D-Day's always been politicized.
Yeah, but not in that nature.
Reagan did his full-blown Cold War a bit in 1984. 2004, everybody was trying to wail on Tony Blair over Iraq.
But to go to isolate Russia and to remove Russia's massive, you know, horrific sacrifices during the Second World War to contain Nazism for this purpose, I just can't imagine anybody wanting to champion that argument.
It would be pointless. Also, we need to ask ourselves whether, you know, it is really the case that Russia would be isolated, or else it would be sent even further into the arms of the Chinese.
Yeah, so, I think it would be so offensive. Yeah.
I mean, de Gaulle actually refused to go to them himself because he was still sulking about being blindsided over the actual thing.
Now, listen, you're showing your age here. I mean, you know.
Is a positive outcome from this likely, though? Does everybody realize that, you know, Russia realizes that they've had to take a bit of a whacking? Everybody realizes they've had to give Russia a bit of a whacking. Do we hope we've reached the point at which people are going to start to have constructive conversations?
I mean, I hope so. I hope so. But again, the movements of troops and weapons and the heightened language on both sides, Ukraine and Russia, are not really, optimistic. Do not give space for optimism. Having said that, again, the crucial point here is who wants to take care of bankrupt Ukraine. I mean, certainly not the Russians. They wouldn't have the money to do so. And similarly, the European Union. So a compromise is almost inevitable in this case.
I was first in Donetsk as a reporter, I think, in 1996. And it was my first time in that part of the world. It was really shocking. I mean, it was really pretty much, I think, as much of the world was in about the 1940s and 50s. It was so primitive. And you know, that area has had so little help from the Ukrainian central government, the federal government, and that's really why there's so much disenchantment. I mean, there's a sense that what did we get from freedom from Russia? You know, life here is still miserable. There's no industry. All of those Russian state-supported industries that existed have gone, and people are despairing. You know, as in so much of the world, discontent can be traced back to economics.
Okay, well, we shall see how all this pans out tomorrow. Of course, if Putin had a sense of humor, he'd invite everybody back to Crimea in February to celebrate the anniversary of the Yalta Conference.
Can I just say that one good thing that's come out of this is that, you know, this G8 was meant to be in Sochi, the world's most, you know, expensive summer or winter resort. They moved it to Brussels. They used some old facilities. What a relief. These G7s, G8s, G20s, you know, Italy spent something like $75 million preparing a palace for its G8. I mean, the kind of ridiculous showmanship that's going on for these conferences. There are so many buildings that are appropriate. It is a relief to see this become a modest affair.
Can we apply that little wisdom to the World Cup?
We'll be talking about that shortly.
Funny you should bring that up.
Jeffrey Kaufman and Oscar Guardiola Rivera will be here with me on the other side of the break when we'll be discussing, among other things, the fallout from the homecoming of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is the journalist and Monocle 24 regular Jeffrey Kaufman and Latin America expert Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Let's look now at the story of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. And rarely in the field of human conflict can yellow ribbons have been removed from old oak trees with such alacrity. His return after 5 years in Taliban captivity has descended from homecoming hero fable to PR disaster and political farce at an astonishing clip. His hometown of Haley, Idaho has now cancelled his homecoming party on alleged security grounds. Jeffrey, first of all, how did this descend into such shambles so quickly?
It's American politics. I mean, you know, what do you expect?
We can probably move on to the next subject.
Yeah, let's talk about the World Cup now.
Let's swap a party for Congress hearing.
You expect the Republicans to applaud anything that Obama does? I mean, you know, this litmus test on values that suddenly exists for American soldiers is, it's the politicization of loyalty. I guess it's always existed in some form, but the notion that it's interesting. I was scanning the right-wing and conservative blogs before I came in, and the kind of the vitriolic denunciations of this guy, the kind of prejudging, not knowing whether he has PTSD or you know what his mental state is, what actually happened. The willingness to say that basically they should have just left him.
This is going to become another Benghazi, isn't it? It's going to become an incident which just gets kicked around by both sides.
Well, Obama's certainly being denounced for trading with and talking to terrorists. The exchange of Guantanamo prisoners for Bergdahl leaves Obama open to criticism. And let's face it, Obama has an image problem. We were just talking about image and rhetoric, and Obama is seen as soft. And in doing this, he seems not to have recognized the dangers and the pitfalls. On the other hand, this was a humanitarian gesture. They had a video of this guy, and he seemed to be in failing health, and they were concerned. I mean, gosh, that is what you want your home country to do when you're a soldier in captivity. Even if you did wander away or do some stuff you shouldn't have done, it's not like you sort of sit and say, well, then let them execute him.
Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Latin America is your specialty, where, of course, many governments, Colombia, which we'll get to shortly, not least among them, have ended up, to coin a phrase, talking to terrorists. Is it kind of time we move past this idea that governments always wheel out that we don't talk to terrorists? Because everybody does.
Well, precisely. I mean, listening to Marco Rubio saying that the president has now set a precedent that will encourage enemies to target American men and women is laughable. Firstly, because this sort of thing has happened before, and as we just heard, that kind of litmus test is just bad politics. On the other hand, if I were Barack Obama, wishful thinking, I would just take this opportunity, because the Republicans are saying that the 5 most dangerous inmates in Guantanamo have been released. If that is the case, then there is no point any longer in keeping Guantanamo open. So let us just close it right away. Which would be a PR coup for Obama.
Which is something he did promise to do about 6.5 years ago.
Correct.
Could this get worse for Obama, though, if it does transpire that there is or that any of the allegations being dumped upon Sergeant Bergdahl do have some basis in fact, or if indeed one of the former Guantanamo 5 does take up arms again?
Well, there is a report now just out that says that Bergdahl did have a history of wandering away from his base, but that the security was very lax, discipline was bad, morale was bad. So the context in which that happened is not clear, and the report does not explicitly say that he was deserting. It's just simply that he had a habit of going on little wanders.
There's smarter places in the world to go on little wanders.
Yeah, but having spent a lot of time in Iraq, I can tell you those bases are small and the sense of confinement is huge. That doesn't justify doing stupid things, let me be clear. But it's not as surprising when you're over there that the sense that somebody might do something stupid, who's somebody young and a little bit blind to the risk, might get in the habit of wandering away. Now, whether he was not planning to come back is we don't know.
This story, I suspect, we will have plenty of opportunity to discuss again in future. It's going to run and run, I suspect. We should check in with preparations for the World Cup, which kicks off 1 week from today. Sao Paulo is the latest city grabbing headlines in Brazil as the city's subway workers have begun an open-ended strike. Brazil is not the only place where things like this happen. We saw the same happen before the Olympics here a couple of years ago, where public transport workers in particular threatened to strike. That said, there's been a fairly consistent backdrop of protests and strikes and riots and demonstrations. A week from now, when Brazil kicks off against Croatia, is it all going to stop? Is Brazil actually ready for this?
Well, certainly won't stop. You wanted a World Cup Latin American style, you're going to have one. You know, together with a mini revolution. I mean, to be more serious, it is the case that all polls, all numbers are telling us that a important portion of Brazilians are dissatisfied with the way things are going, But now we have a workers' movement. This is the homeless workers' movement marching to the Corinthian Stadium in Sao Paulo, telling the government, a leftist government, that they should stop compromising and that to spend $6.5 billion in stadiums and so on and so forth when you have no education, no hospital, and so on is just unacceptable. So this is a very mature demand, actually, on the part of the Brazilian population. Having said that, this does not mean that we won't have a party. There will be a party. The World Cup will be a party. This is Brazil. This is Latin America. We do this. We party one day, engage in revolution the next one.
And I think you can look at Johannesburg, the World Cup in South Africa. Yeah. There were dire predictions that it would fail, and there was every reason to think it would, and yet somehow they pulled it off. You got to hope that that's what's going to happen here. And what tends to happen, and we saw this, I covered the Olympics here, and boy, the stories day after day before the Olympics how disorganized they were. Security.
We had to call the army, remember?
Yeah, exactly, the army. And of course, it was the most glorious Olympics ever. And so I think what you have to hope is that the country will on June 12th, when it begins, will pull together and say, okay, let's just let the world see that Brazil can actually do this.
Just very finally on the World Cup and briefly from each of you, tips for a winner? Jeffrey,
I'm going to punt this one over to the footballer here.
Brazil, Argentina, and maybe Belgium.
Brazil, Argentina, and Belgium.
Maybe.
Interesting dark horse there.
Sounds like a good restaurant.
Depending on who's doing the cooking and who's waiting the tables. We should come to you finally, Oscar, on the Colombian elections, which we will be covering in more detail with our correspondent in Bogota shortly. There's a runoff 10 days from now between President Juan Manuel Santos and Oscar Iván Zuluaga. Is it still too close to call?
Too close to call, and it might become a game changer for the entire region. Now we have a contest between the far right in Colombia and a coalition between the center right and the center left. If the latter wins, peace negotiations will continue as they have. If they don't and the far right wins, we're going to have certainly a stop of these negotiations, but also the possibility of renewal of the confrontation between Colombia and Venezuela. Does anybody want that in the neighborhood? No. But we Colombians do have a tendency to shoot ourselves in the feet. There is an ongoing joke according to which if we Colombians were dinosaurs, we would vote for the meteorite.
but serious question following on from that, though, if a vote for Zuluaga means a potential return to war with the FARC and a potential conflict with Venezuela, what, in at least as far as his supporters are concerned, is the upside?
Well, the upside is this idea that somehow you need a hard line and you have to win the war and FARC are evil and Venezuelans are evil. There is this specter called Castrochavismo, horrible word. And there is this idea that the Venezuelans and the FARC are ready to take on the country, and somehow Santos became from one day to the other a strong communist. I mean, it's total nonsense. But it has to be said, Uribe, who's the real man behind Zuluaga, remains an extremely popular figure. Remember, populism is not only, the property of the left. Here we have far-right wing populism, and everybody's quite concerned about the implications.
Oscar Guardiola Rivera and also Jeffrey Kaufman, thank you both very much for joining us.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
And there's plenty coming up in the second half of today's installment of Midori House. We'll hear from the journalist and author Justin Marozzi about his new book, Baghdad, City of Peace, City of Blood. We'll run through the day's news out of Bogota, and we'll finish the show with a review of the newest books from Paris. Before all of that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you very much. The Russian President Vladimir Putin, uninvited to today's G7 summit in Brussels over Russia's role in Ukraine, parried the snub with a terse message of bon appétit for world leaders who lunched without him. The G7 nations cancelled previous plans to hold the summit in Sochi in a protest against Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimea region back in March. Syrian rebels living in Idlib have said today that the re-election of President Bashar al-Assad for another seven-year term was nothing more than a fraud. Assad won 88.7% of the vote in the presidential election. In the Canadian Maritimes, the search continues for 24-year-old Justin Bock, wanted over the killing of three police officers. They were shot dead after responding to reports of an armed man dressed in camouflage unit outside the city of Moncton in New Brunswick. And Libya's Coast Guard has picked up over 100 immigrants in its waters to the west of Tripoli on Thursday. The 114 men, mostly from Senegal, were detained when they were trying to cross to Europe in a small boat. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Moscow, which makes it 18:32 here in London, and that'll be 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and today we're heading to Bogota, where our correspondent Anastasia Maloney joins us. Anastasia, welcome to the show. We were just speaking to Oscar Guardiola Rivera about the presidential runoff due 10 days from now. How is it looking? Is anybody looking like they're getting ahead?
Not really. I mean, it's too close to call. It's a neck and neck, really tight race. One poll gave the opposition candidate Zuluaga one percentage point over the incumbent President Santos, who's hoping to win re-election. But it's impossible to say who's going to win. I think it's going to come down to the wire with perhaps maybe 300 or 400,000 votes between the win and the loser. But there is a slight advantage that Santos has. Yesterday got some good news because the one of the presidential candidates that was defeated in the first round of voting, Clara Lopez, she has explicitly asked her supporters to vote for Santos. And she got 2 million votes, and she's particularly popular in Bogota. So that could help and give a little boost to Santos and perhaps give him the edge. But again, no one's daring to say who's going to win this very tight election race.
We were talking to Oscar there about the likely consequences of Zuluaga victory, because there is an awful lot riding on, I mean, there's always a lot riding on presidential elections, but this one especially, because the future of the peace process, such as it is in play here, and there's also a potential conflict with Venezuela. So I want to ask you the same question that I asked Oscar a short while ago. From the point of view of the people who are voting for Zuluaga, who clearly has a huge, huge support, what's the upside if those are the risks they're really willing to run?
Well, Zuluaga is running on ticket that basically says, I want peace, but I want peace with justice and not impunity. And he's really tapping into the fears that many Colombians have, that if there is a peace deal, that the FARC will simply get off for their war crimes, and that they will take political power, and that they'll become congressmen and senators, which simply Colombians don't want to see. So those that are voting for Zuluaga would say, we're not against peace, but we just don't want peace with impunity and for the FARC to ever hold political office and hold political power. There is a lot at stake, as you say, in these elections, because it's likely that Zuluaga, if he was elected, would at least, at the very least, make the peace process more complicated, and some are saying, in fact, would scrap the peace process. Whereas if voters who are backing Santos, they are saying that they will do that because they believe in this peace process and they want it to continue.
Another factor that some say, or another possible thing that some say may contribute, may be a contributing factor to the result, is that the day before, I think I'm right in saying, the runoff, Colombia is playing Greece in the World Cup. Colombia haven't been in a World Cup since, when, 98 was the last time, I think?
Something like that.
Is a feel-good factor likely to redound to the president's benefit?
Well, some analysts are saying that because the election is so tight, then you have to look at other variables and factors that could affect the outcome of this presidential election. And as you say, a feel-good factor, if Colombia does win this massive, important match against Greece, could actually boost Santos' chances because people will feel good, morale's high, and that they're likely to go to the polling station and cast their vote for Santos. However, if Colombia loses against Greece, people are saying that that might favour Zuluaga, simply because people wouldn't be feeling so great, or perhaps they wouldn't even bother to go to the polling station after all. And those are the factors that some people are looking into because it's so close between the two candidates.
In general, how optimistic are Colombians feeling about the World Cup?
Well, a bit worried because they don't have Falcao, who's their main striker who plays for Monaco, who's an absolute star. So they were hoping that Falcao would have recovered from his knee injury in time, but Colombians just found out that he, in fact, won't be playing for Colombia in Brazil at the World Cup. And some people are saying that, you know, without Falcao, who is going to score those goals that Colombia will need? So they are optimistic, but I'd say that after the news about Falcao, I think people are less optimistic, but no one's saying that. I mean, they are backing their team 100%, and of course, as you say, they haven't qualified for the World Cup match in the last 16 years, so they're just so excited to see their team play again.
Well, a winnable group, I'd have thought, as well. Ivory Coast, Greece and Japan. But anyway, we should move along finally to a Colombian sporting triumph, which is in no doubt at all because it's happened. A 1-2 in the Giro d'Italia. Is this a big deal in Colombia?
Yeah, this is a massive deal, and people are still celebrating it. So Colombia has had, in the 1980s and 1990s, they dominated cycling in the European Tour. And this recent win in the Giro d'Italia last weekend, Nairo Quintana, the Colombian, the young Colombian, came in first. Rigoberto Urán came in second. The Colombians dominated this race, and everyone's still celebrating and talking about it and analysing it and really saying that this is the confirmation of the Renaissance, the revival of the heyday, the glory days of Colombian cycling, which has just been confirmed by these two fantastic wins in Italy last weekend.
Anastasia Maloney in Bogota, thanks as ever for joining us. Up next, we'll be hearing from Justin Marozzi about his new History of Baghdad. You're listening to Midori House.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's 1839 here in London. Many challenges face any author who proposed to write a history of Baghdad. A lack of material could not be said to be among them. Since Caliph Mansur commanded his masons to lay the city's first bricks in AD 762, Baghdad has been a locus of power, trade, culture, and war. This extraordinary story is told now in the first new English language history of Iraq's capital in nearly a century. Baghdad, City of Peace, City of Blood by Justin Morozzi. Justin visited Midori House earlier today.
There is masses of history for a place that's been around almost 1300 years. So I thought I would concentrate on some of the great moments, which are the first 500 years, the Abbasid heyday when Baghdad is basically the world capital, culture, science, music, poetry, great military power as well, and the capital of the Islamic world. Then after that, a couple of very devastating invasions, Genghis Khan's grandson, Hulagu 1258, and then Tamerlane 1401. And for the next 500 years after that, Baghdad sort of slides off the map. It becomes a remote outpost of the Ottoman Empire. A bit less interesting. So I sort of compress that stuff, and then it all starts hotting up again, late 19th century, Brits involved, Germans, French. And Baghdad sort of becomes a target for the imperial powers for influence. And in the 20th century is a catalogue of bloodshed and disaster again.
What is it that has made Baghdad this extraordinary, it has been an extraordinary centre of diplomatic power, of political intrigue, of trade, of commerce, of art? Is it just an accident of geography? Is it just one of those cities that, because it is where it is destined and doomed to have everybody traipsing back and forth through it?
Yeah, I suppose what makes Baghdad, what made its location favourable to found the city and also made it a very attractive target for invaders. So when Mansur founds it in 762, it's because it's on the Tigris, it's near the Euphrates, trade south, north, east and west. Then equally, when the power shifts to the east and the Mongols start looking west, they sweep across the Asian steppe, and Baghdad, sits there like a jewel, ready to be raped, pillaged, attacked, and destroyed and burnt to the ground.
You've lived in Baghdad on and off these last few eventful years, especially. What was your first impression of it? Do you remember?
Yeah, I think my first impression was one of sheer terror. And within moments of arrival, I was getting a security briefing from one of these security companies telling me that if there were any dogs we saw on the side of the road on the what was called Ambush Alley then, Route Irish, into town, chances are it would be an IED, an improvised explosive device, or what you and I would call a bomb. It was incredibly hot. It was incredibly noisy. Black Hawk helicopters around, gunfire in the background. It was very dramatic, very hot. And in a way, I suppose, emblematic of Baghdad in many eras. You know, violence is the one great constant in all of this history.
Did you learn to like it at any point? I mean, I've only had two very brief experiences of Baghdad, once during the previous administration, in which I found the people lovely, but the fear of living under Saddam Hussein was extraordinarily pervasive. It was like part of the weather, in that, at mixed gatherings of foreigners and Iraqis, if a foreigner even mentioned the family, every Iraqi would stand as one and leave, because they did not wish to be in a room where people were even discussing the family. And I was there the second time, I think around the time of your first visit, where there was far too many things blowing up to actually sort of get a sense of what might be pleasant about this place.
I would probably answer that by saying that I grew to like and love the Baghdadis, the Iraqis, very much, rather more so than the city, which Saddam Hussein has turned into a dump. The infrastructure was neglected. Their streets were overflowing with sewage. It's the consequence of a decade of sanctions, two Gulf Wars, and when I was there, the same time as you, Baghdad was in a pretty tattered state, well past its glory days. All the old buildings have disappeared into the mud from which they were built. Very little Abbasid era stuff to look at. And when you were there, you talked about the terror of Saddam from 2003-04 onwards. When I was there, it was the terror, I suppose, of a bomb going off in a marketplace. And Iraqis would say to you, if this is democracy, we preferred Saddam.
I heard the, if this is democracy, you can keep it thing a few times myself. But researching, I guess, going back especially over the 20th century of Baghdad's history, approaching that as a British historian, how did you end up feeling about the British influence in what is now modern day Iraq?
I suppose it depends who you talk to. If you talk to sort of Sunni grandees who now live in exile, I'm thinking of a couple in the States and some I know in London as well, their eyes go a little bit misty when they talk about the 1950s and they say, oh, those were the glory days, peace, prosperity, strong, vibrant cultural life in the city and so on. And a lot of that they do associate with the monarchy. But, you know, as you say, it was a British idea. It was British supported. It aroused the fury and anger of nationalists over time. And it was a very short-lived experience, really. It was 37 years, 1921 to 1958. And like many things in Baghdad, when it ended in a huge bloodshed. And, you know, the royal corpses of the royal family being dragged through the streets and hacked to pieces and ridden over by cars. And that was the end of that. Iraqis have never had monarchy again. And I never met another one, an Iraqi, who'd like it back.
I remember meeting one Iraqi who wanted it back, whose name currently escapes me, but he was the guy who fancied himself as the king, the next king.
This is Sharif Ali Hussein, who I also met, campaigning to be the next king of Iraq.
Yes, he bombed
completely in the polls.
I interviewed him in an industrial park in Hounslow or somewhere. It was some unglamorous reach of West London. I remember wishing him well, but not. I didn't think this is a guy to back.
He was quite a character. I think he'd been a merchant banker in London, very civilized. I just thought probably Iraq in 2004 was a bit too rough and deadly a place for someone like that.
The book is, of course, it's about Baghdad rather than Iraq. Do you end up perceiving Iraq now as a coherent whole, or do you think of Baghdad as an entirely separate thing unto itself?
Well, I was researching a bit of journalism the other day and talking about Baghdad in Iraq to Iraqis, and the sense of pessimism was not astonishing, because I'm used to it, but it was depressing and disappointing. And the lack of national unity was one of the real themes, whether it's the Kurds in the north or the old age-old Sunni-Shia divisions. Of course, Iraqis feel Iraqi, but there isn't that very strong glue gluing them together. Maliki, the current prime minister, is doing what many leaders in the past have done, which is just exploit these divisions. I mean, he's got death squads targeting Sunnis. Swathes of Western Iraq are in al-Qaeda's hands again. The country is in complete turmoil.
Is it possible, I guess, which leads me to a fairly inevitable question from that, you talk about the pessimism of Iraqis, and they would, of course, have every reason to be pessimistic, especially if betting with form. Do you perceive any reason at all to be optimistic about, I guess, the immediate future of Baghdad?
That's a very tough question. And I suppose with a historian's hat on, perhaps you could say it's only been 10, 11 years since Saddam was toppled. Things could hardly get worse. But I think people thought things could hardly get worse than Saddam Hussein. And life today in Baghdad is probably worse now than it was under Saddam. And the sheer level of violence, I think 9,000 people were killed in Iraq from violent deaths last year, 25 a day. Now, Saddam was brutal, and I'm not going to sit here, you know, as an apologist for Saddam Hussein, but things are as deadly as they ever have been. So it's difficult to be optimistic, but you could argue perhaps that these are the first steps in towards a more democratic form of government. But it's difficult to look ahead with too much optimism at the moment, at least.
I also wanted to ask generally about, I guess, the process of writing Middle Eastern history from the point of view of a British person, especially. The British are perceived across the Middle East of having been at the centre of no end of nefariousness and perfidy. It's not your first book about Middle Eastern history, but do you approach the subject with any kind of nervousness about how it might be received in the Middle East?
That's an interesting question, and I haven't thought about that specifically before. I mean, of course, you're right to say that Britain, as well as other European countries, have played strange and often very unhelpful roles in the Middle East. I mean, the very borders of Iraq were drawn by the Brits, Gertrude Bell, Sir Percy Cox, and others. The borders have also caused numerous problems, as you know, in the Middle East. Sykes-Picot, 1916, carving up the Middle East as the Ottoman Empire crumbled.
The Jordanians still call that dent in their border Winston's Hiccup.
I hadn't heard that one before. That's a good one. I found a lot of affection towards the Brits in some quarters, hostility and suspicion in others. I'm not sure I would say it governed the way I wrote the book at all. And I think, you know, covering the last 10, 20 years or so, I've tried to remain as completely impartial as possible, you know, neither taking one side or another in what's happening, but just observing and reporting, really, with a bit of a reporter's hat on as much as a historian's.
And just finally, do you have any plans or ambitions to return?
I've just got back from 14 months in Mogadishu, where I got a little bit too close to the suicide bombing brethren. So I'm just very happy to be back in the UK at the moment, not wondering whether something next to me is about to go bang loudly.
And that was Justin Marozzi, author of Baghdad, City of Peace, City of Blood, speaking to me earlier. The book is available now and is terrific. It's time now for a bit of music. We will shortly be discussing the newest books of the week in France, but a song to bridge, after a fashion, our final two discussions. This is Le Coeur à bout de doigts by Jacqueline Taieb. Le Coeur à bout de doigts by Jacqueline Taieb there. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's time now to take a look at the best and very occasionally the worst in the worlds of television, cinema, theatre and books. It's our daily cultural wrap-up. And today we're talking books with Charlotte Pudlowski, who's the culture editor for Slate France. She joins us now from Paris. Charlotte, welcome to the show. What have you been reading recently?
Thank you. Well, the last book I've been reading is Sagan 54 by Anne Birest. And Anne Birest is a young contemporary writer. She's in her 30s and she has published a few nice books. And here it's actually a request from Françoise Sagan's son. And Françoise Sagan, I don't know how well known she is in Great Britain, but she's an illustrious French writer and she was embodying women's liberation, delusions of grandeur and love for fast cars and casinos. And she published her first book, Bonjour Tristesse, Hello Sadness, when she was 18 years old in 1954. And so this year, 2014, is the anniversary of this book's first publishing. And François Sagan's son asked so young Anne Birest to write a piece about his mother and the famous book.
So how has she approached this?
Well, you know, the result is actually mesmerizing. It's partly a journal recounting all the steps that Sagan had to go through that year, 1954, from writing the manuscript to having it published. But it's also partly autobiographical, and that's what is very original and very interesting, because, you know, Anne Birest is confessing about her inner turmoils while she's writing about Sagan, and she has just separated from her daughter's father, and diving into literature and into Sagan's work is her escape.
It sounds quite similar in structure to Laurent Binet's HHHH, his sort of postmodern story of the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich, which he kind of interleaved with sort of his own autobiographical ruminations on whether or not the book he was writing was any good.
Yeah, exactly. The structure is similar, but I have to say the story is, you know, lighter here. It's you know, not as a big subject as it was in HHHH. But yeah, there is this kind of parallel between two times, and that's the link between those two stories that is very interesting and very fascinating. It's, you know, reading this book feels like watching a tennis game between a top-rated veteran player and a young up-and-comer, and the veteran dominates, but they both need each other to play, and that's where the beauty is, and that's what the book is really about.
Okay, well, I wanted to ask as well, you've also been reading, this is an unknown book by a very famous author.
Yes, it's called Le Vin des Morts, The Wine of the Dead, and the author is Romain Gary. Romain Gary, who he committed suicide in 1980, and he was one of the greatest French writers of the 20th century. He was famous for being a genius novelist, obviously, but he was also famous for marrying Jean Seberg, and eventually he became mostly famous for being one of the most amazing literary crooks, because, you know, after having written for years as Romain Gary, which was already a pseudonym and under which he won the Goncourt Prize, he decided one day to secretly take on another pseudonym, Émile Ajar, under which he won the Goncourt a second time, something that is forbidden under the prize's rules.
He wrote this book when he was 19, which begs the obvious question of whether or not it's any good, because most things that most 19-year-olds write aren't.
Well, you know, it is very good. The story is very original. It is a journey under the ground, and the hero, Tulip, is stumbling into the underworld, which it turns out isn't so different from the world of the living, with its cops and madams and soldiers. But, mostly, maybe it's not as good as his other works, but it's very interesting to understand it because the book here is quite clearly the genesis of not really Romain Gary, but his successor, Émile Ajar. And several themes found in Ajar's books you'll find in this novel and some paragraphs. That's really fascinating. You can find almost unaltered in ulterior books. And so it's really a key, you know, for his whole work, and it's amazing that we only discover it now.
The key question, I guess, is whether it would still seem as interesting if it was written by somebody else, if it existed in isolation, or is it only interesting because of what we know it followed from it?
You know, you're right. Of course, it's interesting because it is by Romain Gary, but I'm not sure this is, sorry to say, but the relevant question to ask, because it doesn't matter the light we read it under. What matters is that it's really amazing to read, and it's really key to understand the whole work. So it's still a great pleasure, and that's what really matters when you read a book, I think.
Okay, finally then, I wanted to ask about a French novel set in San Francisco. It's very easy when writing. I mean, there's any number of cliches about France as well, of course, but it's very, very easy when writing about America, if you're not American, to lapse into those cliches. Does this book avoid that?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a very big issue we have, because we sort of have a habit in France of using American imagery to forge our own tales and to set our stories, you know, in the U.S., and some of our great writers did it very successfully, very brilliantly, like Louis Ferdinand Céline, you know. But recently, this tradition has taken a turn for the worse, and our three best-selling authors right now, who are also among the worst contemporary French writers, I don't know if you know them, they're also translated, but it's Marc Lévy, Guillaume Musso, and Catherine Pancol, and they're always at the top of the charts in France, and they're always setting their books in and around the East and the West Coast in big, you know, New York apartments, and, you know, it's filled with the worst cliches about life in the big city you can imagine. So it was a great surprise to discover that we can still, you know, write books about the U.S. that are not filled with a cliché. And now this book we're talking about, The Nights of San Francisco, it's called. It's by Caryl Ferret, who's usually known for his thrillers, and he wrote the book, the movie Zulu with Forest Whitaker is based on. And so he's published this one, and it's a very short book where an Indian whose tribe was killed in the Wounded Knee Massacre meets a young American woman who's been amputated. It doesn't sound very funny. It's not very funny, but it's a very good book. And they have both lost part of what they are, and the book is the story of these two ghosts meeting on a dark night in San Francisco, and with their drug-infused love story obviously headed towards another disaster. And the way the author beautifully depicts the meeting of these two butchered lives reminds us that, you know, skinny people in beautiful clothes taking strolls in Central Park is not the only way we can borrow American imagery.
Charlotte, we will have to leave it there. That's The Nights of San Francisco by Caryl Ferret, and that was Charlotte Podlowski, culture editor for Slate France. And that's all we have time for on today's show. My thanks to our guests Jeffrey Kaufman and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. The show is produced by Alla John, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlotta Robello, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. The Urbanist follows after the headlines. I'll be back at 2200 for The Daily with Chloe Potter, but for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.